Yeah, it's cool. It's interesting to know actually how many founders actually are short-sighted. I wonder whether anybody's done a measure of this.
I think people become short-sighted because they're like, obviously like us, working too much as well, don't they? I used to have perfect eyes. My eyesight was perfect until like 2 years ago. So.
And then you started doing a lot of screen work and stuff like this. And
yeah. And squinting and getting annoyed and like putting stress on my eyes.
And I would even say the shift to remote probably has also pushed a lot more people to short-sightedness because we're looking at screens a lot more than we ever were before, right?
And nothing else. It's not like you're not really doing anything else, are you? Because at least in a, you know, when you commute, for example, or you go into the office, you're actually looking at other stuff.
Yeah, it's all about throw distance as well, isn't it? Like how long you focus. And if you're focusing what 2 feet maximum on a screen, that's where your short-sightedness will go.
And anyway, folks, cool.
We're talking about short-sightedness because it is actually a disability and we all suffer from it. And our friend Ewan actually has lost his specs, which is potentially a catastrophic disaster. But no, welcome everybody to Founders Focus. We're live, everybody, so welcome to the show. It is episode 11, and this is the show where we get up close and personal with the founders who are making the technologies that are changing the way in which we work today. This has been a really thrilling series for me. I'm always like a recruitment technology person at heart, and it's great to see new people try new technologies, even new twists on old technologies, doing interesting things in the space and trying to attack the incumbency that's in the market. So delighted to welcome Ewan Cameron and Andrew Wood, the co-founders of Willow, to the show. So welcome, guys.
Hi, thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks. Awesome.
Great to see you too. And if I always start off with the first question, it's like, you know, when you're founding a recruitment technology business, it's like hyper busy, right? There's no time where there is time. So I need to say, so what kind of like busy stuff have you like had to cancel to appear on Founders Focus today? Was there like anything important? I'm kind of concerned that, you know, we're interrupting your roadmap here.
Lunch for starters, but
it's vitally important to refuel.
Very important, yeah. But we're basically having like a outbound day with the sales team, so I head up the sales side of the business. So I'm delighted to have a little break from cold calling to join you today. So yeah.
That is actually a really good segue to the first conversation because there's a lot of glamour. There's a lot of glamour about startup tech, fundraising, all that type of stuff. People see it from the outside. They see the TechCrunch article and all the rest of it. But listen, there's actually a lot of grind involved that people don't see. And you're saying, Andrew, and maybe you may need to get involved in this as well, I guess, on the BD side. But when you're young and a young and hungry company, you've got to get in there and you've got to start knocking on doors. There's no other way you can do it. Tell me a little bit about that journey. Like how was it for you in your own mindset when you started the business? Were you aware that this was going to be a big component at this stage of your business?
I think at the very start, I guess I'll go first because I suppose at the very start, it was a real digital marketing effort. So we started putting out ads on social, ads on Google, and then quite quickly realized that wasn't going to be enough to really kickstart things. So we literally just started being really scrappy. And I think throughout the whole conversation that we'll have today, a lot of what we talk about will be that what we've done is quite scrappy. And that's how that's how a lot of startups get to where they want to be, right? You got to be scrappy and kind of pull things together and make it work. And going back to like very early days of BD, I used to send about 50 to 100 Twitter DMs a day. Just like in the evening, I would like literally sit down on the sofa and instead of watching whatever crap was on TV, I would just go through and send DMs to people like, hey, we just built this thing. Do you want to try it out? And that was really the really early stages of just trying to do it. It was just a case of like hitting everyone like high volume, like going out every single day on Twitter and going out with a really like personal, hey, we've just built this thing, give us some feedback. It was quite honest and open at that point. But then obviously, Woody will probably add some light to where we are kind of over the past 18 months, it started to evolve into something a little less scrappy and a little less crappy sitting on the sofa.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So my background's in basically sales. I've been in sales for 11 years working for a division of Randstad called Pareto Law that quite a lot of people know, especially in the tech startup world. So I was cold call, you know, my first job, I was making like 450 cold calls a week to, you know, sales directors, et cetera, trying to sell them grads with training. So it's actually a bit of a passion of mine. I still, you know, did it when I was a senior salesperson, still loved cold calling. What's been really interesting over the last probably 6 months with Willow is we still have this great sort of inbound engine, but now we know, okay, what clients of ours love using Willow the most, are the most ingrained, etc. So we can start to go, okay, well, actually now our outbound is less like, let's send 100 Twitter messages and hope somebody speaks to us. It's more like, okay, how do we find the next, you know, volume-based recruiter that really sees the power of asynchronous video interviewing? So, so yeah, it's evolved a lot even in the last 6 months. What I find really interesting in the startup world is the startup economy, and just how founders lean on each other to get introductions. And, you know, one of the biggest things that you do as an outbound founder is find other founders that, you know, are potentially looking in a similar market, complementary product, all of that kind of stuff. So a lot of our time's actually spent doing that. And some of the time it can be completely pointless, but other times it's really, really, you know, got really fruitful in terms of what we get back from it. So it's always
That's a really interesting insight, Andrew, because I think that's actually very different from the recruitment space where people are very defensive. You know, you definitely don't speak to your competitors in a collegiate manner. You know, you feel as if you're really competing for the scraps on the table, so you can't be showing them anything. But what you're saying is in the startup world, and I'm kind of addressing people here that might be thinking about doing product at some point or thinking about launching something. There is, once you make the move, it's almost like a big Rubicon you cross, isn't it? Where suddenly people kind of respect the risk that you've taken. And they understand, you know what, that's a boat I'm in also. Oh, that's a boat I've launched like 2 weeks before you guys. And I totally understand where you're at. Let's help each other, because there's no point in being relentlessly aggressive. You've actually got to kind of connect and use those networks that sort of otherwise invisible to you. So super, super interesting bit of insight there, Andrew. Staying with the BD side, because I think this is something that in recruiting itself has lost a lot of, I wouldn't say cachet, never had cachet, but there seems to be like an increasing conversation that, you know what, the entire idea of going outbound is a bad thing and you shouldn't do it. But you're saying, you know what, there's no way a passive approach is going to work. Like, you can stick any amount of ads out there, but people are not going to come through that. You need to actually identify a relevant audience and try and make a proactive approach. That's the only way to get customers in. Do you have any commentary to make on the conversation that's going on about how sales is meant to be done?
Yeah, probably too much, to be honest. We could take over the whole call about how sales should be done. And, you know, we obviously at the moment we have a freemium product. We were going product-led growth and all of that kind of stuff. But actually, the people that I think the difference between what sales is now and what it used to be is I used to make 450 cold calls and I used to handle objections, you know, and it was very much like boiler room sort of, no, I'm going to be the best salesperson that you've ever seen. And then you're going to want to hire salespeople from me. And that's kind of the mentality, right? Whereas the evolution of sales now is an educational data-led role, right? So you've got to find firstly the people that are going to be right for you, who's using it, why are they using it, how can they effectively use it, and then you educate the audience over time. So it's not like we're bashing out, you know, 100 phone calls a day, we're finding specific companies that we want to speak to that are going to benefit from our product, but they perhaps don't know it exists, or they're reticent of it because they've had a bad experience of it in the past. Or, you know, it's that education piece that makes a huge difference in the sales world now, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But that opinion, I think, is totally solid. And it's an underrated skill. You know, I think there isn't a successful startup. I don't think there's a successful business out there that didn't have a high competent sales function, because there is that gap. There's a discovery problem. People don't know the solution. They often don't know that there is a potential solution to a problem that's there. And you know, the role of outbound is really to do that bridging of the gap. And we haven't figured out a technology to do it. I'm looking all the time. I'm looking for a disintermediator to come in. Can they kind of match a buyer with a seller? And you can't. Yeah. It's exactly like a recruiting problem. You don't know when the buyer is ready to buy. The buyer often doesn't know that they're a buyer. So all of those things are in there. So this is why you need to fill in those gaps, which is going to be good, because I think everyone in recruiting and everyone paying attention to anything I do typically has come through the recruiting world. And all of us have picked up that phone. I'm not sure whether we've made as many as 500 calls a week, Andrew, but we've all
wasn't very good. That's why. You know, some people would be like, "Yeah, I've made 3 calls, 3 appointments." I'm like, "What? I made 300."
There's a quality and volume and quantity, Andrew. You know, sometimes you gotta really cover the bases. So I totally get it. Okay, so. The interesting thing is, one of the values of doing the outbound is that you do get to understand which kind of companies or customers are right for you. So having done this exercise, have you identified what is the ideal target segment, like the ideal profile of a customer for Willow?
We have, yes. I think there's kind of multiple. It's so multifaceted. And actually, if you think about what we do as a business and you look at the kind of range of roles out there, if we took, for example, the barometer of like an experienced hire to an inexperienced hire, anywhere along that journey, you could use sort of one-way video interviewing. Generally, the less experienced, the closer to application you use, and therefore the higher volume you do. Now, obviously for us, the people that are using it the most are the best clients, basically, or the ones that are using it the most effectively. So typically it's higher volume roles. So whether that be early careers or whether that be, you know, like cleaners in an airport or whatever it may be. So anybody that's hiring at that kind of volume that wants to get the personal aspect of an individual without having to do, you know, 500 telephone interviews that, you know, 50% of them they can't get through to, and then 50% of them are no good for the role, you know, and so on and so forth. It just whittles down those numbers. So typically that's where our kind of ideal client profile is. But then right on the other side of the spectrum, you've got people using it for CEO roles. And the reason they're using it is to have a really equal panel-led interview process that you can refer back to in the future that multiple stakeholders can look at without it being like an incredibly intimidating interview with 7 board members and 1 potential recruitee. So there's lots of different ways that people are using it, but for us, obviously, the more volume, the more tied in you are.
You said 2 really interesting things there, Andrew. I want to just sit on those a little bit. Firstly, a little bit of insight for people who I think are fairly familiar with this type of technology now, one-way interview, asynchronous video interviewing. I think we know it, right? I mean, if you don't, please let me know. But it's the idea that you set interview questions often in a landing page. People read online what these are and they record a response, 30-second response video, boom, next question, 30-second response or whatever, however many seconds it's set to. And one thing you said was interesting is if it's a higher volume role, it's better deployed closer to the application. But if it's a lower volume senior type of position, there's a different purpose for the recording, it's pushed further back in the recruiting process. And I think that's a really important insight, because a lot of the problems or criticisms people have is that they don't quite understand the positioning of when it's appropriate to put an asynchronous video interview in. I think when it's an inbound, it's an advert, and people know that this is the process, I think it's totally okay. People have applied with a view, yes, this is how it is, they understand that's the next step. I don't think that's a candidate experience issue, which is oftentimes you get, you know, the feedback to say, you know, candidates would prefer to speak to a human being, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. That's debatable whether that's true for a start. Yeah. It's true. I don't want to speak to a human being.
If I can avoid it.
100%. You want at some point, right? At some point that might happen. But the very early stages, the telephone screen, the even these days, the Zoom call screen, why is it better for me to have a synchronous dialogue there when I can compose myself, get myself set up, and just respond with more control? It's going to take me less time. As a candidate, I know how long this thing is going to take. It's not going to be a 45-minute sort of issue, or it may, you know, some people actually perform better or worse based on their psychological profile, for instance. I know a lot of people are really, really uncomfortable with in-person connectivity sometimes. This way of assessment, I don't think you can dump it as saying it's bad candidate UX. I think it could be a very good one. But it's important where you position it. And where I've seen people make errors is when they've already had dialogue with somebody as a candidate, and then they send them an async, and it's like you've already had the conversation, so
work in that, you know, we've seen it really not work in that instance when you know I can say this as a recruiter, some recruiters are quite lazy, right? So what they'll do is they'll have an initial telephone interview with somebody, they'll ask them the same questions that they then send them in a video interview, and then the candidate's like, well, you've already asked me these questions, like, well, you're not listening the first time around, and it's not supplementing the information that you have. We're not trying to be a substitute, right? We're not trying to get rid of any part of the kind of interview process. We're trying to supplement the information that you have to have a much more consistent, rounded view of an individual before you put them forward to a hiring manager or before you hire them yourselves as an individual. So it's that kind of stuff that people get annoyed with. And then on your point about the sort of candidate experience and all of that kind of stuff, obviously we can share the stats with you, and like 80% of people that do a Willow have never done a video or asynchronous video interview before, which is quite high.
I'm surprised at that for sure.
But
that's been like that for about, that's 18 months it's been like that as well, so we would have thought obviously over that 18 months that would have shifted, but it's still only 20% of people that go through a Willow have actually completed anything like this before, which is interesting to see.
Maybe market adoption isn't as quite as wide as I presume.
I'll give you a real life sort of example of that. If we went to IHR Live, so In-House Recruiter Live, last week, and the number one question that we got asked, so what is one-way video interviewing, what's different between that and Zoom, and I would say probably about 75-80% of the leads that we got, they did not know what asynchronous video was.
I may be completely overestimating the literacy of the audience in this case, because I assumed that, everyone knows this, but maybe not. Perhaps video, especially with the shift to remote, is now being like our focus is, of course, it's a Zoom, it's a synchronous experience. But what we're talking about here, it's asynchronous, and that's actually critical, because what it does is it changes the logistics of it. It means two people don't have to coordinate diaries. And it means that you can do, as a recruiter, you can actually set the interview and actually conduct far more asynchronous video interviews, almost at infinite scale. So it's a hyper-productive thing for a recruiter to do. And I think if you're hiring at volume, graduate recruiting scheme, you've got contingent workers that you need to come in or whatever, and you feel that this is an important component for you to have some sort of a dialogue with the worker, you have to have the solution. I mean, it would make no sense for you not to do it. So whether it's Willow or any of the others that are out there, then this is something you should try. Let's jump out of the product for a little bit, guys, and go back in time just a little bit. You're both like pretty young fellas, from how I see it.
Thank you.
Maybe just good plastic.
Woody is just out of makeup.
And diet going on. I don't know, but it looks like, you know, you might be fairly new to the idea of doing. You know, you're not one of these like multi company veteran type folks. What was the? How did this start as an idea? I mean, when did you feel that, you know what, this is a problem that requires a solution like this? Was there a moment where the penny dropped for you two?
Well, I'll kind of jump in there, I suppose. So it goes back quite a long way, and it goes back to about 2016 when I was hiring people, and I previously was hiring for other startups, and I got to a point when I was hiring in a particular business where we needed super enthusiastic salespeople that didn't have any, they didn't come with any preconceived idea of what sales was, because we were going to train them and kind of help them become salespeople for this company. So we started obviously asking for CVs, and the CVs were a real mixed bag. And it was quite frustrating because we couldn't really get a sense of, you know, they might say that they had done some stuff at school and college and university and maybe had one job. We didn't really know what they were like as people on the phone or whatever. So then I actually just started asking them for videos. So I would just say, could you send me a quick video answering this question? And I would just email them a question. So this is like, obviously 2016, most of the people didn't even really have very good quality phones. You know, the cameras were a bit rubbish, so the videos tend to be pretty poor quality. And I also got a lot of videos that wouldn't open, like random files and stuff that would come through that didn't work. But the ones that did work, and I guess the reason that was exciting, it was a light bulb moment, was that the ones that did work and the videos that I could watch, it was like, this is amazing. Like, I don't even care about the CV anymore. Like, for example, there was someone, I think he was 17, just out of school. He had not had any work experience whatsoever, so his CV was pretty much non-existent. But we saw this video come through, and I was like, this is the guy. Like, this is the perfect fit. He's like super enthusiastic. He knows exactly what the company is all about, what the values are. He's done his homework. Let's get him in for a face-to-face and start him like next week. And that was the light bulb moment. I was like, holy shit, all hiring should be done like this. Like, why are we bothering with these bits of like crappy paper that, like, you know, I don't even need the paper. I just want the video. So that was the light bulb moment. And then we spent, you know, a few years after that. So sort of 18, 19, Woody and I spent a lot of time, but just really going through all the existing solutions that were out there. So when I first, you know, was inviting people to send in a video, I didn't realize there was platforms out there. You know, just like today, a lot of people still don't know, because it's not, you know, mainstream. But yeah, we looked at all the platforms that were out there and started to actually basically, you know, critique them. You're going through Capterra reviews, going through G2 reviews. A lot of the solutions out there were actually quite poor. And if they weren't just poor, they were also really expensive. So I was, you know, making cold calls to a lot of the traditional one-way or asynchronous video platforms that we'll all have heard of. And I was getting quoted things like £25,000 a year minimum contract value. And I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. I just want a couple of videos. This is insane. And also your experience for candidates is really poor. So we took all of that intel and actually decided to design, obviously, a better version of what was out there. It was cool. It was like, I mean, it sounds really obvious now, but in any kind of startup, I think the most important thing is to look at what is already in the space as a starting point, because you can always do things better. And I guess that this is one of the exciting things about speaking to you today and having the chance to kind of share our story, is that obviously there is other video interviewing platforms out there, but what we decided to do was actually take all the stuff that people weren't doing very well and try and build on that and use that as the sort of stage to make Willow. And then going one step further, so the final piece of that puzzle was actually sitting down with candidates and saying, hey, candidates, if we gave you a video interview, imagine if I gave you my phone and I say record an interview, what would that interview look like? Like, would you want the questions? Do you want them to pop up? Do you want it to be timed? Do you want to see yourself on camera? There was a whole bunch of questions that we went through, interviewed nearly 200 candidates over the course of 2019, with zero like agenda. I was literally like, if we reinvented the interview, what would it look like? And then they would come back with all kinds of crazy feedback. you know, the most outstanding bits, I suppose, this year was that they wanted control. So that was the most important thing that people felt that they wanted in a job interview. Because typically, obviously, we've seen in some of the comments on LinkedIn as well that candidates aren't really given any control in a traditional interview process. You know, they're invited to a particular place at a certain time, and they're asked a bunch of questions that they've never been prepped for or told about before. And so there's like literally no control. You're kind of just submitting yourself to that employer's wishes. And so we kind of flipped it on its head and gave them the control by putting it into the process. So yeah,
what kind of control did they get? I mean, what are we talking about? The timing of it, how long it takes,
Time, location, and actually how long it takes as well. So not just when they do it. So you know, for example, if I'm a person that's already working, maybe I'm working till 6 p.m. every night and I really like my job, I'm not going to like jump out of my job to go to an interview for a job that I might not get. Whereas I can go on the interview at 7 p.m. at night. So that's the first point of control, is like the time that the interview actually takes place. So I just go on whenever I want. 7 p.m. works for me. I go on to Willow. And then you've got obviously the control of the place. So I can do it in my office, in the house, for example, because it's a nice quiet space, which is obviously good for me. And then I've also got control of actually how long the interview takes. So we don't, for example, say that once you start a Willow interview, you have half an hour to complete it, because that's obviously not control. We say to the candidate, listen, it takes as long as you want. So you can obviously, you know, you can go and make a cup of tea halfway through. You can go and have a breather. You can go and, you know, put your baby to sleep or whatever and come back and continue where you left off. So those are the three kind of key elements that we took from those candidate interviews in the very early days. It's just about really giving them the control to actually own that interview. And obviously, if you control the interview and you control that process, you're going to have a better experience. It's pretty obvious.
I think even the sense of agency is important, isn't it? One of the things that's true about recruiting in general is that it is an inequitable experience. It's the employer, you're going down a funnel, the employer's designed that funnel, and you know, what hoops do you want me to jump through kind of experience. Yeah. That's basically why we hate it. You know, the reason that you look at all of the candidate experience feedback, the pride, you can all track it back to the fact that the candidates had no input into the experience. But if they are able to exercise a little bit of control, that goes so far down the way to making it right. And I think, you know, some of the feedback that we've been getting, the negative feedback we've been getting on the category, which is, oh, asynchronous video is actually bad for candidate experience. The fact that you've turned that on its head and seen that as something to build upon could be a very strong factor in your favor, because yes, there is a circumstance where people feel negative towards it, but if you can kind of make sure that every Willow interview doesn't have that experience, then suddenly you'll start emerging from the market as a different proposition. Okay. We haven't talked about how you two met. I always think when there's two co-founders in there, it's almost like, you know, when was the first date kind of thing. I mean, did you know each other from before? Like, how did this happen? When was the first time you two met?
I'll let Andrew go. You've got better memory.
We've been courting for many years. So Ewan went to university with my now wife. You know, this is kind of I've always wanted to start a business. It's always been my goal, is like, have a good career, learn a lot, which I did at my previous employer, great employer, learned so much about sales, met, you know, so many different startups, scale-ups, you know, enterprise clients, got a lot of knowledge from that. And I would write down every day, I'd write down three business ideas. I came up with some utter rubbish. And basically, I knew Ewan through my wife. So they went to university together. We basically went out in Glasgow a few times. Ewan and I obviously started chatting, blah, 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 blah. And then in 2016, Ewan told me about this idea he was having and all of that. And, you know, kind of started to look at an MVP project on his own, et cetera. And I just kept an eye on it. And I said to my wife one day, like, I think I want to do what he's doing, but I think he might be doing it slightly wrong. And she was like, well, why don't you tell him? And I was like, well, yeah, I could do that, or I could try and do it myself. What do you think? And she's like, no, I think you should probably do it together. So I was like, yeah, that sounds like a better idea, because I have no idea about, you know, how to build a technology platform, whereas Ewan's done it before. And that was where it was born, basically, from a relationship perspective. So Yeah.
So we have your we have your better half to thank for this.
Correct.
Because otherwise you two might be foundering along with like with
competing. Separate products or separate
ideas. Yeah, imagine. We could be competitors getting nowhere. But we've got a lot more just than that to thank for my wife. But yeah, she was the connection.
But what is interesting here is the complementarity of it. Because when you're trying to set up, it's so important when you do set up any kind of business that you, you know, partner with the right people and you start with the right folks. And there's a complementarity between what you do. So Andrew, you're coming in certainly more from industry's perspective. You've got the business, the understanding of recruiting. You have the understanding of recruiting, but from the hiring manager side, but yeah. You have more of a technical background. I think you did some digital marketing and stuff like this, didn't you?
So our split, that's a good point to pick up on. We knew that we had complementary skills, and obviously my kind of, like you said, my kind of background is marketing and product, and then obviously Woody's is more around actually being in the industry and also sales experience. So what we decided was, well, we're obviously good, you know, working together. This is complementary. And then ever since we formed Willow, we've just been really conscious of keeping that split. I think it's really important that you do that. I think if you try and do everything, and I can speak from experience, having tried to do everything before, that if you try and do everything and you're doing sales and marketing and development and finance and stuff, you'll eventually just crash out because you can't do all of it very well. So we've always tried to keep that real like divide as to what we do. And I think that's important as well. You know, if we are talking about people that want to start businesses, whether it's product or any other kind of business, is that you have the right people and don't try and do everything. I know that it's quite common to like try and do everything. And a lot of advice out there says like, if you're an entrepreneur, you should be able to do the finance and the books and all that kind of shit at the same time. But it doesn't really make any sense because you're never going to get any good at most of it. So you're just going to do a crappy job at most of it. Do a bit of it well, and then overall you're not actually going to succeed. Whereas we kind of have a nice split.
I think what this is going to sound really ridiculous, and I've never thought of it until now, and thought of it, whatever. But if you think Ewan and my skills, we have complementary skills. So I've got a skill set and Ewan's got it, but then we have a common thread in the middle of like creativity. Like, I know it sounds stupid, but we both are good at DIY. So we can take a problem having never done it before and just get stuck into it and build something from nothing.
Yeah.
And I know that sounds silly, but actually, if you have the kind of business stuff and then entrepreneurship or you know, creative self-starter problem solver is your common thread between the two co-founders, that's a really solid basis to then go, okay, well, whatever problem comes up, like if in sales I've got a problem and I don't know the answer, I can go to Ewan and say, listen, mate, I'm struggling with this one actually. Do you think you could help? And vice versa. So it's very interesting the way that we kind of gel together, if that makes sense.
I don't think you should be so shy to say that it's a stupid thing to talk about, Andrew, because problem solving, it's one of those cliches that when everyone say, oh yeah, of course I'm a good problem solver, but there is probably ways to test this. And DIY is actually one of them. Because you can't go out and buy the thing off the shelf, right? I mean, buying the thing off the shelf is not problem solving. You've literally outsourced the problem to the market. Market's delivered the solution. What DIY is look, you haven't got the adequate parts to get this thing solved, but can you kind of jerry-rig something that is adequate? There's so much about early stage startup, maybe even late stage startup, late stage business that is jerry-rigged. It's just systems that have been kind of patched together. They've been repurposed. They're not meant to be for that, but you've had to jam this in because that's all you had at the time and you've made it work. And I think that's a testable skill. I wonder whether, you know, we should give like IKEA sort of build this thing, and can you do it without the instruction manual or whatever?
That'd be eye-opening, actually. Imagine that, like, you know, one of those complicated IKEA bookshelves, which is a little bit complicated, and Woody and I probably would just chuck the instructions away and just like start building it. Whereas other people, I wonder, you like spread it all out and then look at the picture and be like, that looks like that part goes there, and then eventually it all comes together. I'd love to do that.
I actually think that's where we're different. I would be the James May of IKEA. where I would read every, I'd read through the instructions first, then I'd lay out every single dowley and, you know, nut, bolt, etc., and then I'd do it. So the interesting thing I find about DIY is, like, before I do anything, I'll watch 10 YouTube videos of how to do it.
Yeah.
And I'll take it in, I'll learn exactly how to do it. And I think, again, that's like entrepreneurship on one side that complements the fact that Ewan would just go, right, I'm going to just build the solution straight off the bat. Do you know what I mean? So it's, again, it's even if you delve into it in different ways, you find the kind of strengths that sit with each of the people in the team. So I'm not just talking about us. I'm talking about when you're trying to find a founder, these are the weird things that you should probably ask them.
Yeah, maybe get involved in something that is like this. I mean, it's hard to set up without it being like completely cheesy as, but is it possible for you to do something where you can test a little bit about, you know, the stuff that you, how you behave? Like, I just remember back in school, you used to do orienteering and stuff like this, right? That's all about trying to figure stuff out when you don't have all the information.
Yeah.
And actually, you've got to communicate with a bunch of other people that also don't have the information. Can you collectively get there? And I think something like that is actually a really good way to test how you work together, what the sort of problem set is. Is this person generally a problem-centric person or a solution-centric person? You can kind of surface that out, which, again, you can't really see from CV. Andrew, you keep saying things that want to send me off to a tangent, so I'm going to keep going with this. You mentioned YouTube is critical for your DIY. Yeah. Now, I think YouTube has been a massive resource for people learning new knowledge. Have you used it to do any, like, startup stuff? Have you used YouTube to say, how do I raise a fund? Or have you used YouTube to say, how do I, you know, hire a software engineer? Everything. Has that been a resource that you've used?
Just video in, I would say, rather than YouTube, video in general. Yes, absolutely. So, just across the board, the way I learn is, it is quite visual anyway. So I just love watching videos. So I think, you know, there's organizations like Sales Impact Academy that people might have seen, which is all video-based learning. You can learn live, you can learn ad hoc, etc. So I do some revenue leadership stuff with that whilst I'm rowing in the morning, you know, just watching a video on the side. DIY, literally, B&Q have their own DIY channel. It's like nonstop. I'm on there basically whenever I have something to do. Social media, in our sales playbook, we've got loads of YouTube videos to help the team basically understand discovery, questioning. It's just a really great sort of snapshot overview of a real person talking about their real experience that you can actually learn from. And there's a scary statistic that I talked about. I did a presentation at Rec Expo last week, and I can't remember where I found this statistic, so please forgive me, anybody that looks it up. But 66% of people only gather information through video now. So they did a survey, and 66% of the people only gathered information through video. We're just so used to consuming it now, and it's so much more vibrant and interesting than not having it, in my opinion. Also, I'm a very slow reader, so
It's also more accurate as a search engine. If you go to YouTube, people don't think of it as like one of the biggest search engines on the planet, but I think it is after the mothership itself is the biggest one. But you go to Google, and it seems to me that page one is entirely festooned with ads to begin with. So it's like, this is not what I want. And then page two and three are all by people who are very good at SEO. And it's like, this is also not what I want. And by the time I'm at page four, I'm like hyper frustrated already.
Yeah.
Not in the right condition to treat this information in the right way. Whereas YouTube seems to be a little bit faster to get to what you want.
Yeah.
And you can get something, and as a dude or a person just teaching you how to do it, gives you a sort of an idea how long the video is. You don't have to, you know, chew down on a very long thing. You can say, right, I need a 30-second packet on this. Boom, it's there. So, yeah, it's definitely a resource underused, I think.
I agree.
You're about to say something, I think.
I was just going to say, I think, yeah, YouTube's super niche as well. You can get really niche on sort of topics, whereas I find Google, you tend to just end up, like you're saying, with the person that ranks highly on SEO. Whereas, like, for example, I'm just thinking of an example last night. So I'm looking at holidays for next year. Whenever I find like a holiday, I like look for like people that have been to the hotel in the past 6 months. And all they're doing is like a walk around or whatever, which is quite an easy thing to actually do. So it means you've got like a relevant up-to-date video, somebody walking about. You might see inside their room, you'll see the pool and all that kind of stuff. Whereas if I did the same search on Google, I would end up with like the hotel, TripAdvisor, booking.com. Yep. I'd be like, I'm none the wiser. Do I really want to go to that hotel or not? So it's really cool. You can get really drilled in. And it's also time relevant as well, because you've got the, obviously when the video was uploaded, which means you can go quite niche again on when it was updated.
It's almost like you can trust the authenticity of it, because it's it's a user generated a bit of content rather than something that, you know, has been overly marketed. Hotel selection is classic for that. That's what I do as well. It's like you check it straight away. It'll be some person.
Some random person.
This toilet doesn't work.
I love it. Some of them are amazing.
Saw a double rainbow from balcony. Must see hotel.
I love that. It's so good. My God.
Okay, let's keep talking about entrepreneurship. Let's talk about leadership. What have you learned in terms of leadership that you didn't know before? And I know you've both been senior execs. You've both kind of led teams in previous functions and led departments and so forth. But has there been any kind of new revelations of leadership that you've learned during the journey that you started at Willow? Anything kind of that you've built, I guess, from a personal point of view over the last couple of years? Ewan, go with you on this.
Go with me first. I think, you know what's interesting? I think there's been, biggest thing for me personally has been the introduction of fundraising. So fundraising and how that whole piece works in terms of like, obviously managing the business day to day, and then obviously managing investor relationships and things. That's been a big learning curve for both of us. And I think personally, it's been a really interesting learning curve as well. Just the fact that, you know, over the past 18 months, we've actually been obviously speaking to investors. Before that, in the past 10 years of my career, I never spoke to a single investor. And then in the past 18 months, I've probably spoken to about 50 or 60 of them. And obviously with speaking to investors comes all that new, like, behavior, learning, like you've got to like pick up on all the acronyms that they use, and I guess that's been a really big learning for me. And then obviously how do we run the day-to-day business, but at the same time, how do we also go about speaking to investors to actually pitch the business to them and sell the business? So that's been a really interesting kind of angle and learning takeaway for me. And then I guess from a more of a leadership perspective, the real takeaway again, it's probably been working with a co-founder. So normally when you're working in a business, you know, if you're like a manager or like a director, you're kind of on your own. Like you'll be the director of marketing or whatever. You're the guy that does the marketing and everyone looks at you. Whereas Woody and I are obviously on the same level. We're trying to do the same thing. That's probably been quite an interesting learning as well. And I think it's a good thing as well, because it means you don't feel like you're on your own as much. Whereas often in previous roles, I was like a manager or a director and you were kind of just, you know, if it didn't work, it was you. And everyone just looks at you and they're like, what do we do? Whereas we actually share that, and it's actually quite nice. I think that's been really quite a strength for us to share that responsibility.
That's really interesting. How we'll go back to both of those points, Ewan. I think they're both worth exploring. How about you, Andrew? What kind of leadership insight have you kind of developed over the last couple of years working at Willow?
I think it's very different, right, in terms of being your own boss, inverted commas, and being a boss. What I find quite liberating, and you know, hi team, if you're watching, I hope they enjoy it, but is the kind of the ability to actually be honest, number one, and the second part of that is you make the decision to bear the consequences of that honesty on yourself. And it's your, you know, it's your business that you're exposing to whoever it may be in the team or whatever. And it, you know, it's really nice to just remove the kind of politics and actually try and have a very flat structure in leadership and just be honest with the team. And when you feel, oh, maybe I told them something I shouldn't have, like, you know, what position we are in terms of cash or whatever it is. Lots of things get held back in larger organizations that actually, if you're going to have a team that's truly empowered, that truly feels like they're part of the journey, they should probably know warts and all what's going on. So that's the bit of leadership that I've really enjoyed. The bit that, you know, is totally different, and somebody told me this before we, you know, kind of went formal in the launching of stuff, was as soon as it's your own, it's like a limb. You can't chop it off, you know, and leave it behind. It's literally there with you every day, every minute of every day. You're always thinking about it. There's always something that pops into your head, and you got to try and remember it before the next thing pops in. So from a leadership perspective, you know, it's having the ability to go, okay, how can I compartmentalize? How can I make sure that, you know, me mentally, I'm in the right place to serve the team as well as I can, in order to keep the company moving forward. So they're the two kind of the main things that I've learned, I think, from founding a business or co-founding a business.
I think there's overlap in one of those points, which is the compartmentalization. I think you mentioned it as well, Ewan, about, you know, needing to fundraise on one hand and the other side needing to run it as an operating business. And Andrew, you're now saying, yeah, you're 24/7 every single day, but you also have a life to lead. I mean, you have to compartmentalize your life into away from this as well. So how do you practice compartmentalization? That strikes me as a skill to learn, isn't it? Like, is this something that you just had to batter through, or was there some sort of formula? Was there a framework? Has anybody taught you this? Like, how do you get better at this?
I've absolutely not mastered it, would be the first thing I would say. But Ewan, I think you were going to say something.
I was going to say, if you look inside my head, it basically looks like a Trello Kanban board. That's what I compartmentalize things. So inside my head, it's just little tasks, little cards, and little boards. And that's basically how I've done it. I think I started using Trello about, I don't know, 7-8 years ago. And Trello is a great tool if anyone's watching that doesn't use it. It's also free. And basically just allows you to kind of, obviously, In the column here, I'd have like fundraising, and then I'd have all the tasks for fundraising. And then over here, I'd have like people, and it'd be like hiring this person, this person, this person, and product. And that's, I guess, how I do the compartmentalization piece, is just having visual sort of boards, quite a visual person. So yeah, that's been really useful. It's actually a really good tool for startups in general, because when we were starting Willow in the early days, because Willow wasn't our full-time thing, like I was running a digital marketing agency at the same time for like a year, and I would have the Trello board for Willow. So what I could do is I could go into Trello, and then I'm like absorbing that information. I know where I'm at, all the tasks are there. And then I can go and do my other business the next day, safe in the kind of mind that all the stuff for Willow is still on the screen. Yeah. Like it doesn't need to stay in your mind, because that's, I guess, one of the hardest things about, you know, doing, you know, a business like we're doing. We have lots of different departments to look after, because we can't afford all the people right now. So we have to think about all the different departments, but not every department can be in your head at the same time. So it's good to have like somewhere like Trello to dump it all.
You reminded me about Trello. I've forgotten about it for a couple of years. I used to be well into it, but for some reason I've stopped using it. But sometimes you need to, as you say, get it out of your head. The main problem with compartmentalization isn't if you're trying to do it entirely within your skull, you're actually spending a lot of cognitive energy doing that. The trick is to just drop it out of your head and then focus on the one thing at a time, and then have the thing brought back in. So you can certainly train yourself to do it. Okay, another leadership point. I think, Andrew, you mentioned this. The second point you mentioned was this this notion. Actually, no, let's talk about the collegiate experience. So you're working as a pair. This is beneficial because you can share the problem set, you can get different perspective, you can do different things. Sometimes it can be challenging also, though, because you have to talk to the other person, right? I mean,
nightmare. Most of the time it's a nightmare.
I'm so glad you've opened up this can of worms.
How do you make a decision where one party has a strong opinion that is not the same as yours? I mean, have you got a conflict resolution system? Do you know how to make a decision when, you know, literally you might think opposite of what the situation is? How does that work?
The two things normally happens. One, whenever we have a dispute, it ends in a joke and we both end up laughing. So it's, you know, the conflict is resolved in the argument, first and foremost. And secondly, usually what happens is if we're not sure, we test something. So we will test and test and test. And if it doesn't work, we both hold our, you know, each other accountable to that test. And that's what you have to do, really, because there's going to be times now, there's going to be times in the future, etc., where you've got to be prepared to fail with a view that, you know, you might succeed with something that you think is wrong, actually. And it might actually be the, you know, the magic that helps your business grow and turn into something that you didn't think it could be. So we're pretty good at that kind of stuff, I would say. And then we're also fairly good compromisers. Plus, you know, if an investor asks, Ewan is the boss. So if we are in a split jury and Ewan strongly believes against my belief, we'll go with Ewan's option. With a view that if that doesn't work out, then we'll revert back. And that's, you know, it's important to have that kind of governance. God, what a horrible word, especially for a startup. But it's important that we have that, you know, that relationship where I feel comfortable enough to go, yeah, Ewan, do you know what? You're the CEO on this one. Let's revert to your decision if we're not going to test what I think.
I think, I mean, that sounds like you've already got a very mature way to deal with it. I know lots of companies that have never actually even got to that point where it just is a very persistent wrestling match between, you know, strong-willed people. And you think, wow, all the synergy is just getting spent on conflict. And, you know, you're not pushing the business forward by doing this. If anything, all you're doing is eroding the relationship. Andrew, you mentioned number one, you've got to maintain the relationship. That's got to be a priority concern for founders. Like, it can't be something that is not intentional. So, you know, you've got to keep the humor there. You've got to understand how to compromise. And secondly, you know, you can almost like get the dispute out to a test. So it's not, again, about force of will, or, you know, trying to play the boss card or whatever, but it's like getting it out and let the market decide what it is. Mm. And then final point is there is ultimately a decision maker. That's the purpose of having a CEO, is to execute the final call if that's required. And that's also clear. So yeah, I think that's a, you know, it's already quite a mature way of thinking about those things, I think. And again, lots of people never get there, or if they do, they end up solopreneuring because they can't get there with other people. You know, they're a personality type, they can't get to that situation, or sometimes they're not fortunate enough to encounter people of like mind. You know, you go to Hacker News, for instance, and didn't they launch like a founders meet type of recruiting service? Because that's a persistent problem. Like, lots of smart people with great ideas, but then for some reason they've not been able to find that person within their own circle, and they need to do the terrifying thing of trying to found a business with a stranger.
My advice on that is find a second degree friend that you get on with, because actually, you know, Ewan and I, we weren't best friends before we started the business. So there's no sort of like, oh God, what if I say this? Then we're not going to be friends anymore and it's going to damage the relationship. Like, I could turn away and go, he's your friend, Hannah. You know, let's just call it quits.
A disposable personal relationship is what you're saying.
But I knew.
But no, I know what you're saying though. You're totally right. It's like business first, for sure. Like, I think we are quite good at that, I suppose. It's not, I don't think it's planned, but you're totally right, Woody. I think the business comes before the friendship, which in other situations, it could be the other way around. And that would be horrible because you're trying to maintain a friendship at the cost of the business potential.
That's a really good point of putting it, Ewan. And I think you're entirely right. It's like there's a distance, the priorities, the business, that's the shared space. You know, the thing that you care about is in that middle between you. And you don't have a parallel, you know, social baggage, let's say, that is, you know, that will evolve over time. But I mean, that's not the priority concern when you're setting up a business from the get-go. So that's really, really interesting to know. Okay. Talking about transparency, it's a point I really want to key on as well. Andrew, you saw that this was something that was very different from working in a business that wasn't your own. Because you have to toe party line, you know, there is board meetings, there is management meetings, and the, you know, at the end of the management meeting, everyone emerges like literally on the same page. And obviously the staff are thinking, what are they on about? But you're saying that isn't the case with Willow for now, because transparency is the way. Do you think it might change in future? I mean, as you grow as a business, I mean, is it a natural evolution of companies that they end up compartmentalizing the information a little bit? Or do you think that's just the legacy of kind of, you know, older corporate practice?
I'll give you my favorite analogy that I came up with. So when we started the business, we were in a taxi, right? So let's say in a taxi, everybody can hear what everybody's saying. Ewan's driving the taxi. You know, we know where it's going. It's easy to see. We're now at a minibus, right? So I can still turn around. People can still see out the front. I can turn around and go, oh, by the way, this is where we're going. Just making sure you know, et cetera, et cetera. The next stage is then a coach, and then you have to get on the microphone, and then you're on a double-decker bus. And what happens with a double-decker bus is you have to have somebody that goes up to the top deck and goes, oh, by the way, guys, this is where we're still going. By the way, this is where we're still going. Where I see it fall down in corporations is you don't get or grow the people with the business who have the same vision, who are connected to the leadership and know the values, behaviors of the company that you want to build as it scales. So I can't answer that question, honestly. I really hope that we've got the right people now so that in 3-4 years, as we become a double-decker bus, they understand that actually transparency is what we want from the business. We want an honest, you know, open, easy to work with, empowered workforce. And if there's a problem, it needs to come back to us. So I hope that that's what we can build effectively. And I guess we're very cognizant of it at the moment.
What a wonderful analogy. I never thought of the transportation aspect, but you're entirely right. It's a really good way to think about it because, you know, at what point is it impossible for the one person to address the entire business? There will be a point when that's the case. And that's when you need to start thinking about some procedures, some systems that will help you bridge that gap. There's actually a really interesting post I'm going to share in the newsletter on Sunday from First Round about how you scale a business and the phases of scale is how they describe it. And cool. I thought this was really interesting because they were brave enough to put a number on it. Oftentimes when people say, yeah, scaling, it's all contextual driven. Yes, we know that, but give us a number. And they end up saying, yeah, between 30 and 50, it looks like this. And then probably by the time it's beyond 50, and the analogy they use is in a room. So not entirely a vehicle, but when it gets too big to get everyone in the same room, then actually your company changes, necessarily changes, because you at the very least need to do two conversations or you need to find other ways to do it. And they end up just keep describing the scale of the company up until about 900. And I just thought, okay, you can disagree a lot with what they're saying, but I like the fact and the bravery of them putting it into sort of segments like this so that you can get an idea as to when these changes might occur. Okay, cool. Listen, let's go back to the product a little bit. You guys have raised some money. You've got a live product out there. You've got even people in the chat stream saying, yep, we love the product, etc. What is down the pipe for you guys in 2022? For people who are using Willow right now or thinking about using it or thinking about using asynchronous interview technology, video technology, what can they expect from Willow in the next 12 months?
Good question. I'll take this one. So I guess over the next 12 months, we just started a head of product on Monday, last Monday. So our head of product is heading up our product development now, which is really exciting actually for us. And development's really, I guess, our to make the interview experience more rounded. So make it more of a conversational interview and introduce different types of questions, for example, into the interview. So a little bit like what we were saying earlier about building that flat pack furniture, like can you actually introduce different types of questions? So perhaps it's, solve this problem in JavaScript and the person can actually solve that coding problem or, you know, show us your portfolio and they can actually like build a portfolio on the platform or, go and complete this test or so actually building in different components into the interview so that it's not just about video, it's actually a whole piece. Because like going back to the reason that we started obviously the company, we want to eventually replace the cover letter and the CV. And there's certain things that a cover letter and a CV actually captures quite well. So it's like how do you bring in some of that good stuff into the Willow interview? So it's not all just video and questions. there's more to it. So the I guess to kind of give it its working title, it's like a 360 degree view of the candidate. Yeah. And making the interviews more conversational and natural. So that's the piece. And I guess you'll notice that I'm talking about the candidate experience here. Obviously, the recruiters and the businesses pay us, but we're really just focused on the candidate, because without the candidates, no one's going to use the platform. So over the next 12 months, the majority of work is actually on that candidate experience.
That's actually a really smart play as well, because I can tell you from my conversations in the industry that people have put the candidate experience right at the top in terms of priority, particularly with regards to candidate shortage. They're very, very aware that if they've got an unpleasant experience into their companies, that's going to be a huge deterrent for them. It's going to be a big impediment for them to recruit. So I think you're sitting in the right sort of values, really, from which to build this product, which is great to see. Let me leave you with a final question, folks, because we're running short on time, but I want to just a big part of the reason why we do Founders Focus is to get into the mindset of people who've set up businesses and have taken a risk to do it. And potentially people watching the show or listening to it on podcast later on or whatnot, maybe thinking, yeah, I want to do that, but I don't know how. What advice would you give a wannabe entrepreneur that hasn't yet pulled the trigger? What kind of things would you say that, you know, that you can impart on that person? Maybe if you could speak to yourself in five years ago, you can give them a bit of advice. What would that be? Go to you on this one first, you, and then we'll go to Andrew later.
Okay. I'll go really quickly for you, seeing as we're wrapping it up. My short answer is get something out there as quickly as possible. So I did what I used to do. I've got like a whole list of notes on my iPhone with business ideas. Business ideas are nothing, right? They're just crappy ideas. I think the advice from me would be just pick an idea and go with it. Get it out there. And it can be as crappy as you want it to be. Like Willow was really crappy in the early days. It was really bad. But we got it out there and obviously then built on it. So I think that's probably my advice there, is just to get it out there. Like whether it's a physical thing or whether it's a software thing, or it's a service thing, just like put it out there. Even if it's just like launching a website and getting somebody to sign up to say they're interested in whatever you're selling, even if it doesn't exist.
Get out there and learn from it. That's the thing.
Super important. And folks, it's almost like the action kind of pulls you forward, right? It gives you momentum. If you just leave it there as a list of ideas, it's going to stare at you tomorrow. What you've got to do is get it out there and it'll drag you forward, because things will start happening once you do it. It's action orientation, ship the damn thing. Okay, how about you, Andrew? One bit of advice that you could say to a budding entrepreneur thinking about it.
I'm going to do two really quick ones, if that's okay. Learn more in 6 months starting your own business than you'll learn in 6 years working for one. So that makes you entirely employable if everything goes wrong. So I wouldn't worry, really. Because if you do it and it doesn't work out, people respect you, you'll get a job. Two is care less what other people think. Don't listen to the naysayers. Just get out there and as Ewan said, just get out there and give it a go and learn from it. And if it doesn't work out, do another one. If it doesn't work out, do another one. And then you'll very quickly figure out whether it's for you or not. But, you know, it's with the talent shortage that we're in, it's relatively low risk, in my opinion, but maybe that's why I did it.
Wonderful comments, Andrew. Basically, the risk is in your own mind to a large degree, because there is always job opportunity back. You know, if you're the type of person that has the skill set to do some entrepreneurship, generally speaking, that is something employers desperately need anyway. So you could basically roll it back. But it doesn't have to be one of these definitive decisions that, oh, you fail forever. No, you could burn this one and just move on. No biggie. The second thing you mentioned, Ewan, was, you got to trust yourself, right? You speak to enough people, you're going to get enough people that are going to say no. So, you got to back yourself, in this and other things as well. Okay, cool. Listen, anybody who's listening to this and they want to get in touch with you too, and they want to sign up to Willow, how did they do that?
So go to Willow.video, Willow.video, And you can sign up for a free account or request a live demo with one of our lovely team, including Woody and I.
Fantastic. Can they make a specific request? They may do after this.
Yeah,
of course. I want to speak to you and I want to speak to Woody.
Yeah, I get a lot more demo requests.
Happens all the time.
You know what? You should probably set that as a premium service or something. You know, like, I want to speak to this guy. Okay,
our demos would drop. We would lose our demos.
That's it. Willow.video, folks. If you don't know asynchronous video, you should do. This should be a product you should check out. And particularly if you're already using it and you care about candidate experience, if you're already using a asynchronous video technology solution, have a look at these guys because they're looking at it from a candidate UX perspective, and I think it's a really important and timely place to start building a business. Okay, that's about it. I hope you've enjoyed the show, folks. We'll catch up with you soon.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.